In many old Western movies, robbing a train seems easy, glorious, rewarding, brave, even. For over 100 years, captivated audiences have watched from their living rooms or local theaters as robbers on screen climb onto the roofs of trains, run across their tops, their cowboy hats perfectly in place, eyes gleaming through the black and white film, before dropping into the locomotive cabin, brandishing their guns, and getting away with bags of money. The robbers grin smugly and tip their hats. They've just made millions. In these movies, the line between villain and hero becomes blurred. The Wild West of train robberies looks like a world where riches and revenge are just sitting around for those brave enough to come and take them. But there is one glaringly obvious thing that allows these stories to be so gleaming, so shiny, and so simple. They are movies, works of fiction. The characters have been designed to be the perfect amount of charming and defiant. Their backstories explain to us so that we can empathize with their character and understand why they would commit a crime like this. In their world, we forgive them. We root for them. In movies, the crimes are penciled into the script and rehearsed, every detail planned out and practiced. A satisfying ending to the story is perfectly engineered before the movie is ever shot. The danger and thrill is artificial, but real crime is far more precarious. Real humans are much messier, and real life is not rehearsed. The choices we make, be they right, wrong, or devastating, are permanent, and they stay with us forever. Welcome to National Park After Dark.
Welcome, everybody, to another episode of National Park After Dark. I'm Cassie.
And I'm Danielle. And I'm not trying to copy you from last week, but we're doing another train story.
And it sounds like a train robbery story.
In the Pacific Northwest.
In the same story.
It's not the same story, I swear to God.
Yours wasn't Mine wasn't a robbery. I don't know. We do this kind of a lot, though. I feel like we get on the same theme sometimes, and we'll have like back-to-back episodes that aren't the same. But they're kind of related in some way.
It's like
never on purpose.
Same, same, but different.
Yeah.
Yeah. So yeah, another train story. But before we get into that, we just got back from Joshua Tree. So
yes,
thank you everyone who came. It was so fun. Such a fun weekend.
It was the first time we've ever done a camp out live show in a national park. Joshua Tree National Park Association helped put all of this on. They really did the legwork for this to happen. They're a nonprofit organization that works in conjunction with Joshua Tree National Park to help fundraise and do a lot of really good things for the Park Service themselves. So we were really, really excited to be able to be a part of that. And it was great to camp with so many people for the weekend. We had beautiful weather. The show went well. Our merch sold out. Al was flooded with a lot of...
How is he doing today?
He's back at work today.
Wow. I had to take yesterday off. So we got in like super late on.
Yeah, our flight was delayed.
By the time I actually stepped foot in my house, it was like almost 1 o'clock in the morning.
Yeah, I didn't get home. I got to my mom's house around, I think, 11:30-ish, but I didn't get home until yesterday around 4 o'clock. So it took me.
And we were supposed to record this last night too.
Yeah, we were.
I'm a crazy person scheduling that before. So we took some time. But anyways, the weekend was really fun. And it's so funny because we had a very special guest that I didn't know I was in the presence of greatness until.
Or fame.
Until I posted a picture with, so there was this dog that we saw across the campfire, like that we didn't meet them beforehand. We had settled into our campsite. There's about 60 people or so, and we're all gathered around watching Ranger Mark from Joshua Tree do a talk, and it was great. And I just like my eyes gaze across the campfire, and I see this dog in a stroller, this old man, like, you know, Cassie correctly guessed, 15 years old.
Pitty. Yeah.
oh my God, who is that? Went over just thinking it's like this really cute dog and like he has a great setup. His mom is cool. And I posted a picture on
my story of us three together, me, you, and his name is Grandpa Larry. And I shit you not, I got like almost hundreds of people be like, Grandpa Larry, I love that dog. I'm like, how do you know who this person, this dog is? And yeah, I guess he's really famous.
As he should be. He's so cute.
Deserving.
So sweet. Yeah.
He really took the pressure off because everyone loved him. And
yeah. It was like everyone came to see us, but they stayed for Grandpa Larry.
That's true. Okay. All right. So, yeah. Anyway, long story short, Joshua Tree was awesome. And we hope we can do something like that again in the future. And we'll work on it. But yeah, again, we got another train story in the Pacific Northwest.
And I'm all for it. We haven't done a robbery story in a while. And I actually really like these stories. So I'm excited.
All right. We'll see if you enjoy this one.
Well... Now I'm a little concerned just by how you said that, but okay. Okay.
You're allowed to change your mind. But yeah, instead of your story was in Washington last week and mine is just to the south in Oregon and specifically within the Cascade Siskiyou National Monument area at a little place called Tunnel 13, which is just south of Ashland, Oregon. And for full disclosure, the tunnel where our story is unfolding is literally just outside of this national monument. Like I did some map overlaying things. Like I felt like I was like hunting a national treasure or something. I'm like, okay, where is this in relation to this? And yeah, it's like less than 2 miles outside of the boundaries of this national monument. But
throw it away.
But
don't want to hear it.
It's so funny you say that because I'm like, I have to list the reason what list the reasons why I can tell the story. Okay. Number one, it's outside.
That is a really good argument.
Number two, the tunnel is listed on the National Register of Historic Places.
Okay.
And number three, parts of this story will unfold within the National Monument land.
Okay. Never mind. I take back what I say. I'd like to hear the story now.
So it's not my freebie is what I'm trying to say. Don't make me make this my freebie because I have other plans for that. Okay. A moment for the monument because it is so beautiful. It spans more than 170,000 acres in southern Oregon and into northern California. It connects the Cascade, Klamath, and Siskiyou mountain ranges, and it contains an array of forests, woodlands, grasslands, wet meadows, and interior desert. It was the first national monument to be established specifically with the goal of preserving the area's unique biodiversity back in the year 2000. But it's the traditional home of indigenous groups like the Telgema, the Shasta, and the Klamath people. There are over 200 types of birds that circle the mountain's jagged peaks, while bears and mountain lions prowl in the forests below. And fun fact, there are actually more unique butterfly species here than almost any other place in the entire United States.
Interesting.
Yeah.
Are there monarch butterflies there?
I'm going to say yes, because it's a wild guess and it feels like the answer should be yes, but I don't know.
I believe you.
Okay, great. You shouldn't, I guess, but... the PCT intersects the monument as well, and because of that, a lot of hikers find themselves within this national monument for part of their trek, and it winds through breathtaking wilderness. But high up in these very mountains, on October 11th, 1923, three brothers, Ray, Roy, and Hugh D'Autremont, made a series of choices that would haunt them forever. But as with every bad choice, a lifetime of other choices and circumstances led up to that moment. So let's rewind a little bit before that October day so we can better understand it.
Every summer, I get that itch to revamp my whole wardrobe. You know the feeling when temps go up and suddenly nothing in your closet feels right anymore and you just want to dress cute and look nice? And this year, instead of panic buying stuff I'd regret, I went to Quince. And it's been a total game changer. I am a summer dress kind of girl, so I grabbed their 100% European linen scoop neck midi dress in their mauve color, and I am obsessed. It's perfect for hot days, but still polished enough to wear pretty much anywhere. And of course, the quality is the best part. It is fantastic. The quality across the board with Quince is seriously very impressive. We're talking premium fabrics, great fit and clean finishing. And the best part, Quince prices everything 50 to 80% 10% less than what you'd pay at similar brands. I've paid way more for clothes that didn't even come close in terms of quality. That's because Quince works directly with top artisans and cuts out the middlemen, so you get luxury without the markup. And they only use factories that follow safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing practices, so it's stuff you can actually feel good about wearing. This summer, I'm all about easy, elevated style, and thanks to Quince, my closet finally can match that vibe. Treat your closet to a little summer glow up with Quince. Go to quince.com/NPAD for free shipping on your order and 365-day returns. That's quince.com/NPAD to get free shipping and 365-day returns. quince.com/NPAD.
The boys were three of five siblings. Their parents, Paul and Belle D'Autremont, had five sons. Their eldest, Vern, twins, Ray and Roy, then Hugh, and finally their youngest, Lee. The family didn't have a lot of money, and a lot of the boys' childhood was spent moving from place to place in hopes of finding stability and work, chasing the next promising destination. Paul, the father, moved the family to Lakewood, New Mexico, but when they arrived after a very tumultuous journey, they found that the town they were told by promoters would be this lush, beautiful town full of opportunities and resources was in reality a pretty vacant desert town with not much money to be made. Nevertheless, the family tried to stick it out in Lakewood the best they could, all working hard to start up a farm. However, they ran into challenges nearly right off the bat, including the neighbor's cattle eating all of their grass and crops as soon as it was popping up. And with the farm plan kind of out, crumbling in front of them, they opened up a grocery store in town. But with Lakewood's failing economy, that too seemed to be doomed. Largely due to this seemingly never-ending struggle to make ends meet, the boys' childhood was unstable and challenging, and they watched on as a string of bad luck and failed dreams plagued their parents as they struggled to make ends meet and provide for their family. Ray, one of the twins, was particularly upset as he watched his family's hardworking efforts be met with disappointment over and over again, and as he grew up, he started getting increasingly more and more angry about this. Not only about their circumstances, but at everyone he felt that had wronged them and like put them in this type of situation. Their father, Paul, left New Mexico with the idea that he would go find work elsewhere and send money back to the family since it wasn't working out in New Mexico. And instead of schlepping the entire family somewhere else again, he was just going to go out, make money, and support them from afar. When the twins, Ray and Roy, were 16 years old, they took a page out of their dad's playbook and also left home, riding freight trains across the country, taking up jobs where they could find them. And when I was 16, I was working part-time at a local pizza shop to pay for gas money to probably, like, I don't know, spend it at Gloria Jean's for Frappuccinos that were just, like, way too much. Do you remember Gloria Jean's?
I do remember Gloria Jean's. I didn't have one near me, but there was one, I think it was in Bedford, New Hampshire, that I used to go to, and I loved it. It was like a treat when I would go by.
Yeah, it was like my mall thing. Like I would go and get one of those giant.
There was one at the mall?
Yeah, that's the only one I knew of.
Oh.
I think it was in either Manchester or Nashua Mall, must have been.
Hmm.
Anyway.
I remember it there.
But yeah, Ray and Roy were trying to provide for their family, not just getting expensive Frappuccinos for no reason. So they too, they left home trying to find money to support their mom and their additional siblings. The twins made their way to Oregon and found that their father, Paul, was living with a new woman and, in fact, had never sent any money back for them or the rest of their family back in New Mexico. How dare he, first of all, the audacity. And the boys were crushed. They felt abandoned and cast aside by their dad, and this also fueled Ray's anger about their circumstances, that he was the one that was getting really upset with things as he grew older.
Because they're only 16 at this point,
yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
Yeah, so their dad is essentially has a new life, is supporting his life there, has abandoned them, and now they're kind of on their own.
Yeah. Needless to say, life had not been easy for the brothers, and Ray grew more and more bitter and resentful of the unfortunate hand that they were dealt. When he was 18, he joined the radical international labor union called the Industrial Workers of the World. And the group's ideology centered on getting justice for low-paid members of the workforce who were wronged by the class system in America. So these, what that group stood for, Ray really felt like community, found community in, and really felt like, yeah, that's me. And I want to be a part of this. He felt inspired. He felt like he had finally somewhere to channel his anger at his family's fate. And he became a card-carrying member of the union, which was also known as the Wobblies. But after a violent altercation in, of all places, Centralia, Washington, where I lived so close to when Ian and I lived in Rainier, like, it's this tiny little dot on the map. Like, I can't, when I saw that, I was like, no shit. But anyway, and back in 1919, there was this altercation there between the Wobblies and the American Legion, and it turned violent, and several members of the American Legion ended up being killed. So long story short, it eventually became illegal to be a member of the Wobblies, and Ray was eventually arrested for his involvement with the group during another incident in Vancouver. And he was sentenced to a year in jail for that and emerged from his imprisonment even more angry at life. As his brother Hugh later said about his brother in 1927, quote, Ray came out bittered against the world. His mind was saturated with hate. Ooh. He just couldn't shake the feeling that his family was cheated of a good and comfortable life, and was enraged that despite all of their most valiant efforts to work hard and make a fair, honest living, life was just unfair to them. As Noreen Salviat McGraw, who would later serve as an attorney for the brothers, described, quote, he felt that the world owed them a living.
Okay. I mean, I can kind of, he seems a lot angrier and I can't relate to that as much, but I think the sentiment behind hard work should give you a good life. I think that's something that we can all relate to, you know, especially with the economy and stuff just right now. You think that if you're working full time, if you're working really hard, you deserve a good life. You deserve to have, you deserve to be able to pay for what you need. And right. I can definitely resonate with that.
Yeah. So he was taking it very personally, like not only was he upset by it, he was enraged by it.
Yeah. The anger I can't relate to, but the feeling of thinking that you should have a good life because you work hard. I think we can all kind of relate to. It's very fair. Yeah.
Eventually, Ray reached a breaking point. He was willing to do whatever it took to get his family money. Why should he have to play fair when the world had been anything but fair to his family?
So this feels like the very much like the villain story, you know, how a villain is born.
Yeah, this is his origin, like the backstory. Like, you know, when they do a movie and then like 5 years later, they'll do a prequel to that movie.
Yes.
This is the prequel.
Like Cruella de Vil, how they did that one.
I've never seen it.
Really? It's so good.
The one with Emma Stone? Is that the
one?
Yes. Okay.
I loved it. I thought it was great. And it makes you love Cruella de Vil too.
Really? Okay. Yeah.
I feel like you would like it.
I feel like I would. Maybe I'll watch it this weekend.
You should. I feel like you would like that movie.
All right. I'll add it to the list. Once that breaking point came, it was pretty clear in Ray's mind that there was a path out. And that path was a life of crime.
Of course. Dun, dun, dun.
And at the time, in the early 1910s and early 1920s, there was one particular crime that was very prevalent, and that was train robberies.
I feel like I was a train robber in a past life.
Do you?
Yeah.
Like Why a woman, do you say that?
Train robber. I don't know. I just feel like I gravitate to the life of freight trains going across the country. But I feel like I would have been like, I don't know, it was a different life. So I feel like I pretended I was violent, but I wasn't actually violent. And I went on the lam and had a ton of money.
Okay.
Stored away.
Well, maybe I can see the fakeness of it. Like you're like, you have a something in your holster that's a gun, but it's actually like a carved piece of soap.
No, you're like, it's not loaded. I was thinking it was just not loaded, but... Oh. You're really, really making me even less intimidating.
I mean, it would be a good replica. I'm not saying it would be...
A bar of soap would be a good replica obvious. To a gun.
I don't know, whatever. Okay, well, Ray
I could do crime, Danielle.
In a past life, not this one. Look at you.
It's true. Thank you.
Okay, where am I in this life? Where am I in this life? Okay, yeah, so... Of all things, train robberies, that was definitely the crime of the time. But in particular, criminals were going after mail cars of trains because they were quite literally good as gold. They were known to carry valuables and were prime targets for would-be robbers, as they often carried payrolls, large amounts of cash, gold, bonds, jewelry, etc. Like, the mail was everything. And in the newspapers, the brothers read about various successful train robberies, article after article, spelling out the riches that were looted. For example, criminal Roy Gardner was frequently getting away with hundreds of thousands of dollars worth from trains. And then the brothers also read that another group of boys, not much unlike them, got away with a whopping $5 million. So this is in the headlines. It's something that they're like, this is doable. We can do this. Mm-hmm. Other people are doing it. Now's the time. And with money like that, that's money they could not even fathom. But it wasn't just in the newspapers. In movies and books, the brothers saw characters who came from nothing and through a train robbery or bank heist managed to steal their own golden ticket to the good life. Stories like Jesse James, who tore through the mountains and towns of America with a cowboy hat atop his head and a gun in his hand, robbing banks and trains, taking his fate into his own hands and seeking revenge for how poorly his family was treated, was of course very inspiring to the brothers because they saw themselves within mm-hmm. him. And the twins' eyes grew wider and wider with each and every story that they read. They didn't need to become career criminals. This wasn't something that they were like, okay, we need to just reformulate our entire life.
They just need their one shot.
I just need one. We just need one big hit and we're good.
I feel like I could do it once.
A train robbery or a robbery of any kind.
Of any kind.
Of any
kind. Like a bank. I'm picturing a bank robbery in this day and age.
There's no way. There's no way. With cameras on every freaking, in everybody's hand, in every corner, in every building, there's no way.
You know what? I would be, if I robbed a bank, I would be the person who slid. Have you seen someone did this and they slid a sticky note underneath and it just said, I have a gun, give me your money. And then.
Are you talking about one time they did this or like all
yeah,
the time?
Yeah, it was one time. I think they got caught, but.
Okay.
Maybe I.
Wait, then what?
I think that they gave them the money, but they pressed their little alarm silently and then they got picked up after. But the sticky note worked. The person gave them money.
Yeah, but then it didn't work in the long run, right?
No.
Yeah, I think you have to switch tactics. I really feel like it's just kind of impossible to rob a bank, at least in the U.S. or like.
There was someone who robbed a bank near us, like in, I think in my town or something. They robbed it on a bicycle and they got away and no one ever caught them. Oh my God. Actually, this is bringing up so much memories. When I was in high school, one of my teachers robbed a bank and got caught and went to jail.
What?
Yeah.
One of your high school teachers?
Yes. It wasn't my teacher, but it was in my class and it was the math teacher.
It just goes to show teachers don't get paid enough.
Yeah. They worked full time and they had to rob a bank.
Yeah. So, and they're in jail.
No, they're out now.
Oh, so was it worth it?
I don't think they kept the money and they're probably not a teacher
anymore. They definitely didn't keep the money. They're like, you can keep it if you just do some
go to jail.
Okay.
Yeah.
So I didn't know this was so near and dear to your heart, robbing banks.
I just think it's interesting.
Robbing.
Robbing, yeah.
You just think it's what?
I just think like this era. Train robbery time era. I think it's really interesting.
Yeah, well, you did the two-parter in Capitol Reef.
Yeah, with the Sundance Kid.
Yeah.
Yeah.
All about it.
And I always, growing up, I always thought Bonnie and Clyde's story was not, like, I never romanticized it like other people did. I didn't think that their story was, like, this romantic robbery story. I thought it was actually pretty horrific because they were killing people, but I just thought it was interesting.
Yeah. I think I romanticized it.
Did you?
I think, yeah.
Yeah. I never thought, like, I didn't think, like, oh, I want this life. It sounds so cool. I mean, they were killing very innocent people for no reason besides to rob. But even in circumstances where they didn't need to kill people, they did. And I just didn't.
Oh, no. You know who I'm thinking of?
Who?
Do you remember that? I'm thinking of John Dillinger.
Yeah.
What was that movie with that? Oh, my. Do you hear that? It's a train. It's a train.
It knows. Get out there. It's your time to shine.
I hope it picked up on the mic. And if it did, we should keep it in. Oh, okay. Anyway, that's nothing new. This train goes by all the time, but it's just pertinent now. Yeah, no, I don't know. The movie with Johnny Depp about John Dillinger.
Now I hear the train.
Did you hear it?
Yeah.
Let's go rob it. let's pause this.
It's you're closest, so let me know.
I didn't live a past life. I'll sit here and wait. It's not my lane. Okay. Anyways, we're not off topic, but we're off topic. So anyway, the twins in particular are hearing all of these stories. They're infatuated. They're like, we just need this one hit. If we pull off this one robbery, we could be set for life and not have to worry about any of this ever again. Finally give our family the life they deserve. Let our parents or their mom, their dad, they're like, whatever, we hate that guy now. But at least Belle, their mom, they were wanting to support give a comfortable life to. So this high-stakes robbery gleamed with intrigue and hope and offered a complete departure from the thankless slog of labor for the lumber companies and shipyards that they had been working at for years. So now they're in their early 20s, and the twins decide to rope in their brother Hugh into their plan. Because for up until now, it was just the twins. Mm-hmm. And they're like, we need a third here. So they target Hugh, their younger brother. He had just graduated from high school. He got good grades. He was the quarterback on the football team. And he was doing really good until he traveled to Oregon to work with the twins at a lumber company near Silverton. After Hugh got settled, Ray and Roy pitched them their grand idea. They were planning to stage a big heist and rob a train known to be carrying large amounts of money and possibly even some gold. And I can just imagine them painting this grand picture of like ease and luxury, no more hard labor. It was just one crime away. Like Hugh, you know, he just goes to move in with his older brothers, just got out of high school. And they're like, okay, you're settled. Now hear us out. Like this is a big,
this is what we're going to do.
Yeah. And Hugh wasn't on board immediately, but their pitch was hard to resist. Plus he loved his brothers and his family and only wanted the best for them. So who was he to say no to, you know, especially as the way that the twins were just so enthusiastically packaging this idea.
And it feels like they have no intention of harming anyone. It's a one-time thing. They've worked hard their whole lives. This is just like,
well, oh, they don't have intentions of not harming anyone.
Okay.
It's kind of like we're going to get the money and whoever's in our
way. By any means possible.
Yes.
This okay. I didn't realize that.
No one is to be harmed at all.
Okay.
No and worries. People get harmed. So yeah, they were convincing though. And maybe who knows the way that they were really selling it to Hugh at the beginning. I'm sure that they kind of omitted that part. They were just like, this is what we need to do. And this is how
we're going to rob this train. It's going to be a one-time thing. And then our lives are going to be changed forever, which is enticing.
So he was on board. He was eventually on board. And now all three of them start really getting down into the nitty gritty of planning and committing this heist.
Let's be real. Eating well is harder than it sounds. One week, I'm on top of my meals, feeling great, and the next, it's all takeout and chips on the couch. And then I'm left wondering why I'm dragging and not feeling my best. The thing is, it's not about being perfect, it's about knowing what works for you. That's where Faye Nutrition comes in. Faye connects you with a real registered dietitian, someone who actually knows what they're talking about and can help you figure out how to fuel your body in a way that's sustainable and personal. No fads, no weird cleanses, just real smart support. This podcast is sponsored by Faye. They match you one-on-one with a dedicated dietitian who helps you understand your body's unique needs. Whether you're dealing with low energy, digestive issues, PCOS, food allergies, or you're just trying to figure out how to eat without second-guessing every bite, Faye is here to help. And get this, 95% of people pay $0 for their sessions because all dietitians on Faye take insurance. They'll even check your coverage before you sign up. It's literally never been easier or more affordable to get personalized nutritional help. Dietitians on Faye specialize in over 30 areas, everything from weight loss and sports nutrition to women's health, postpartum, gut health, eating disorders, and more. They've already helped over 100,000 people improve their lives. And honestly, it just feels good to have someone in your corner who actually gets what your body needs. Having a personalized nutritionist used to cost big bucks, but not anymore with Faye. Listeners of National Park After Dark can qualify to see a registered dietitian for as little as $0 by visiting FayeNutrition.com/NPAD. That's FayeNutrition.com/NPAD. One last time, that's FayeNutrition.com/NPAD. And make sure you use our URL so they know that we sent you.
So guided by a combination of the reality of their world and the fantasy they saw in movies, the D'Autremont brothers planned out their crime. After scouting out tracks up and down the West Coast, they eventually found the perfect target. Southern Pacific Railroad's San Francisco Express train that started in Portland and headed south to California. The Siskiyou Line was super popular at the time and known for its stunning mountain views. So going down the coast on this train was a grand adventure, and travelers came from far and wide to see the West Coast in this way, through the windows of the Southern Pacific, as it wound its way through the mountain passes and valleys. But the D'Autremont brothers didn't give a crap about any of that. They cared that Train 13, or the Gold Special, as it was called, carried not only sightseeing passengers, but mail, and they carefully planned to rob the train as it entered Tunnel 13 at the Siskiyou Summit. So this is Train 13 in Tunnel 13, just so they're two separate things, but maybe 13 was their thing, you know?
Yeah, 13's their lucky number, or it, not so lucky.
Not so lucky, yeah. They chose this spot with great intention. Like I said, they had traveled far and wide looking for just the right location and train, and this was it. The tunnel was located high up in a remote part of the mountain. The half-mile-long dark tunnel would offer them even more obscurity, and most importantly, Ray had heard through the grapevine that there was often gold on board this train, Train 13, aka the Gold Special, which would pass right through the tunnel on its route. The brothers knew, after careful observation and study, that the train would crawl up the steep incline leading to the tunnel before slowing down just before entering Tunnel 13 to test its brakes, which was a necessary precaution prior to the sharp descent into Northern California on the other side of the tunnel. And it was in this moment that provided the perfect window of opportunity for them to climb aboard safely, because it slowed down, did a little test, and then went into the dark tunnel. After they climbed aboard safely, they would then command the engineer to pull the train forward and stop it fully inside the tunnel. Next, they'd enter the mail car and force the mail clerk to hand over cash, gold, and any other valuables held on board. And finally, the brothers would make their escape into the mountains, taking off with their newfound riches. Or at least, that was their plan. The trio found a cabin just above the tunnel and used it as a base camp for about a month as they continued to scheme and stockpile supplies like weapons, food, and other basics, but also items they needed for their master plan. They stole dynamite and a detonator from a nearby construction site and planned to use said dynamite as plan B. They would blast open the door of the mail car if the clerk did not cooperate with their initial demands. They also planned for their grand escape. Initially, they purchased a car to use as a getaway vehicle, but just days before their planned robbery date, one of the brothers got into a head-on collision with a cow on the highway and it totaled their car. So the brother was fine. He was fine.
But the car was ruined.
But the car was unusable. So as a plan B, they scouted out an area which was basically like this big hollowed out area of earth underneath a fallen tree that was laying over a ravine, which is about 2 to 3 miles away from the tunnel. It would offer shelter and a hiding spot in case they needed a place to lay low for a while. They stocked it with food, blankets, bandages, backup ammunition, and even some blood-stopping powder, like in case they were to get injured and needed to, you know, stop the bleeding. Mm-hmm. So they were prepping for some shit to go down, some violence to go down at least. They also did a lot of target practice and got to know the woods and terrain near the tunnel and spent days watching the passing trains and studying the various timetables of not only their target train, but others that would be coming along as well. They came to know that the San Francisco Express train would arrive at their pre-chosen location at 12:35 p.m. They had done their research, weeks worth of it, and then on the morning of October 11th, 1923, it was go time. Ray positioned himself on the south side of this tunnel with dynamite, while Roy and Hugh, armed with pistols and a shotgun, hiked over the hill to the north entrance of the tunnel. There, they tucked themselves into the brush and waited for the train to arrive. Just before entering the tunnel, Train 13 slowed down to conduct a brake test, exactly as the brothers knew it would. When the train slowed down, Hugh and Roy emerged from the bushes and hurried towards the train. They waited until the steam engine and first three cars passed by before jumping on undetected. Hugh grabbed a ladder rung and managed to pull himself on board quickly, but Roy was struggling. To help, Hugh stuck out one of his legs to help his brother climb aboard, and Roy grabbed onto his leg and managed to pull himself up. Once on board, Roy and Hugh sprung into action. holding a sawed-off shotgun and a Colt 45, they commanded engineer Sidney Bates and fireman Marvin Seng to pull the train forward through the tunnel. Years later, Roy explained this exact moment, saying, quote, "I told Hugh to give the engineer his orders and I would give the fireman his. The orders we gave were these. Stop your train with the engine cab just clear of the tunnel. If you fail to do so, the fireman will take your place because you will be dead. And I gave the fireman his instructions. If the engineer fails to stop the train with the cab just clear of the tunnel, you are to take his place because he will be dead." And they agreed to it. The engineer acted like he thought it was a joke. He didn't act like he thought it was anything very serious. He could see we were young, just kids, but he carried out the instructions to the letter. So essentially, they get these men to do as they're told, and the train is stopped within the tunnel. And now it was time for the most critical part of their plan, entering the mail car. The postal clerk, Alvin Daughtry, had noticed that the train came to a stop. Confused, he stuck his head out to see what was going on because, yeah, they tested the brakes, but they never did this exact,
like full stop.
Right, exactly. And slowly into the tunnel, stopping in the tunnel. That was not the norm. So he poked his head out to see what was going on. And Ray, having entered the tunnel, fired his gun in Elvin's direction, narrowly missing him as the bullet ricocheted off the door and side of the train car. So he's coming in guns blazing. He didn't even ask. Yeah.
He didn't even say anything.
Yeah, he just comes in shooting. Stunned, Alvin quickly closed the mail car door and locked himself inside, refusing to comply with the demands of the intruders. It was clear now that the brothers couldn't scare Alvin into cooperating, so it was time for Plan B, and that was the dynamite. The plan was to use one or two sticks of the dynamite, enough to blast open the door of the mail car, but not enough to destroy its entire contents. But this is where things took a reckless and devastating turn. In the dark tunnel, Roy used not one, not two sticks of dynamite, but all of it. Every stick that they had. And they detonated it, and the mail car exploded into flames. And with it, Alvin Daughtry, a trusted railway employee, father, and husband, burned inside the car.
Oh my God. This just turned from a train robbery to horrific.
And it just gets, it's like, that was like the domino, I feel like that just.
And is Roy the one who's super angry, or was it Ray?
Ray is the one that is like,
who came in guns blazing.
Let me just make sure. It is kind of confusing, huh?
Yeah, Roy and Ray.
Ray is the one that's has all this like built up angst. And
okay.
And him and Roy are twins and they were kind of the masterminds. And then
they're feeding off of each other.
A little bit. Yeah, I would say so. And now they're panicking because things are going wrong. People are dead.
You just killed someone.
Yeah, like they're kind of like their oh shit moment of things are falling apart. This isn't going how we wanted. And they're literally just, they just exploded their target. Everything is burning. There's nothing intact. There's nothing to steal because they just burned it all or exploded it all.
Okay, you killed someone and now you have nothing to steal.
Shielding their eyes from the unexpected huge explosion, the brothers stood in the tunnel, stunned and watching as any gold, cash, or other tickets to a richer life burned in front of their eyes. At the same time, hearing the explosion, several railway employees began to make their way up to the front of the car, assuming that the train's boiler had exploded. Like, they didn't know at this time that they were being robbed. Smoke and fumes from the explosion filled the tunnel, and because of this, most of the employees decided to turn back and regroup. But one, Charles Orrin Coyle, he went by Coyle Johnson, continued forward in an effort to help the train's engine men. When Roy saw Coyle emerge from the dark haze of the tunnel, he threatened him and demanded that he uncouple the mail car from the train so that they could get it out of the tunnel. Realizing the true nature of what the heck just happened and thinking quickly, Coyle Johnson explained to Roy that the mail car was way too damaged and that the train would need to pull forward while a lever was lifted in order to get it out of this tunnel. With no choice but to believe the brakeman, Roy essentially said, "Okay, yeah, then that's what we're going to do," and demanded Coyle go up to the front of the train and tell the engineer, Sidney Bates, to pull the train forward. But when Coyle, complying with Roy's demands, walked out of the south end of the tunnel, Ray and Hugh mistakenly assumed that he had just killed Roy because he was coming from the direction where Roy was, and they immediately shot him.
But Roy's alive.
Yes, but they didn't know that because there's all this confusion. There's smoke. They have no idea what's going on. They're separated right now.
Yeah, but why would you assume that he killed him?
I don't know. Why would you do any of this? I'm not sure. You tell me. You did it in a past life, but I'm just saying.
Mine were successful in a past life, so I can't relate.
You use soap, so.
Yeah, I was a nice train robber in a past life.
So, yeah, they immediately shot him. And just before he died, Coyle Johnson uttered the words, "Those fellows back there want you to pull the thing up." And that was like his last words. And then he died. Realizing what they had just done, the immense failure of their operation is starting to sink in. Everything was falling apart. Two men at this point were dead, and they had a grand total of $0 to show for it. Some time had now passed since the initial explosion, and they knew their time was running out to flee the scene because there are still people around on this train. There's passengers on board on other cars. Like, this wasn't just a mail car. Mm-hmm. So they know that their time is almost up. Panicking, they decide there's no other option but to kill the remaining witnesses.
What? Why?
Roy shot fireman Sang in the head, and Hugh shot and killed engineer Sidney Bates before they fled into the mountains. So they now just killed four people. The only
and
four
they still have no money.
They came in contact with. Yes, no money, nothing.
My puppy Ember is in that phase right now. You know the one where she picks up literally everything off the ground, crumbs, socks, and yes, she's even tried to sneak her head in the toilet more than a few times. She's adorable, but it's also a full-time job. And since I can't control what she's sniffing or licking, I can control what I'm cleaning our home with. That's why I switched to Blue Land. Their products are made to meet the highest environmental standards. Their products are not just clean, they're mom clean. Blue Land products are 100% plastic-free and made with certified clean ingredients that are safe to use around family, pets, plants in the house. You don't have to choose between the safe option and what actually gets your house clean. Blue Land is on a mission to make it easier for everyone to make better choices for their families and the planet. Their products are designed to be effective without compromising your health or the environment. And they're proving that hardworking, clean products should be the norm, not the exception. From cleaning sprays to hand soap, toilet bowl cleaner, and laundry tablets, everything is made with certified clean ingredients. And I mean really certified. We're talking EPA Safer Choice, EWG verified, Leaping Bunny certified, USDA bio-based, and their B Corp. That's a lot of good packed into every tablet. I've been using the toilet tablets and the dishwasher tablets, and they work so well. There's no bleach, no fumes, and I don't worry when Ember is sniffing around the area after I clean. And all of their products are 100% plastic-free and independently tested to perform just as well as the big-name brands. Over a million households trust Blue Land, and now my household does too. Blue Land has a special offer for our listeners. Right now, get 15% off your first order by going to blueland.com/NPAD. You won't want to miss this. blueland.com/NPAD for 15% off. That's blueland.com/NPAD to get 15% off.
The men killed 35-year-old Elvin Daughtry, 36-year-old Charles Orrin Coyle Johnson, 23-year-old Marvin Sang, and 51-year-old Sidney Bates were husbands, fathers, and friends. They were experts in their craft and trusted members of the railway community. Their deaths caused deep loss and mourning, most of all to their families, but also throughout the railway community and throughout the region. But their deaths triggered more than just deep sorrow. People were angry, and they wanted revenge, and most wanted whoever was responsible to not just get caught and justice to be served, but they wanted them to be sentenced to death as well. Like, people were pissed. As the community was reeling, the brothers had successfully escaped to their hideout, where they managed to stay hidden for almost 2 weeks, which was no small feat given the massive search operation underway. Planes circled overhead, the National Guard searched houses and barns down the Pacific Highway, and armed searchers led by bloodhounds combed the woods and mountain slopes near the train tracks, looking for the brothers. It would have been incredibly difficult. Also, just side note, this is October in the mountains of Oregon. Like, this is not...
It's turning to winter.
Yeah. It would have been incredibly difficult to survive in the woods like this. unnoticed for as long as the D'Autremont brothers did. And some think that it's miraculous that they lasted 2 weeks there, but some think it didn't happen at all. Because sprinkled throughout the D'Autremont brothers' story are many mysteries. Parts of this story just don't add up. And this is one of those moments. Forensic scientist Ed Espinoza, who was interviewed by Oregon Public Broadcasting for their documentary they made of this called Murder on the Southern Pacific, is doubtful that the brothers could have survived out in the Oregon elements in late October for as long as they claim they did. His response to the brothers' version of events, as someone who lives in Southern Oregon himself, says simply, "That's not true. You would freeze to death." And like, they did have supplies and stuff. Like, they did have this, like, their holdout did have blankets and other things like that. It wasn't like they just fled and found a random log to sit under for 2 weeks, but still.
So what's the alternative? What do people think they did instead?
I'll tell you. He is also not the only one to say that. I just wanted to, like, point him out because he was part of the documentary. A lot of people are suspicious that that's truly what happened. Most people think that there were other people involved. Multiple people reported seeing a suspicious car leaving the tracks on October 11th. As Ashland Police Chief George McNagg remembers it, quote, "There were four men, possibly five, in this car. I particularly remember that three men in the back seat were slouched down." So he thinks, and other people think, because of this and because of other things, that there were other people involved in this. Like, but
there was a getaway car.
Yeah, but the brothers were the only three, like, on the ground in the train tunnel. And then there was others involved beforehand and after with the planning and getaway.
Gotcha.
But regardless of where they were in the immediate aftermath, they had left incriminating clues at the crime scene and in the cabin that was eventually located. Because remember, they don't know that the brothers did it at this time. They don't know if they're search how many people they're looking for, who did it. They just know this happened.
It happened, yeah.
So through their searching and stuff, they find all this evidence. And among the items left behind were overalls, a gun, and the detonator that they stole. The evidence was handed over to Edward Heinrich, a pioneering forensic scientist who worked as a chemistry professor at the University of California, Berkeley at the time. Heinrich didn't know it, but his work analyzing the evidence left behind by the D'Autremont brothers would change the field of forensics forever. In the late 1920s, crime labs did not exist in the United States, and examining crime scene evidence through a scientific lens was not common practice yet. But Heinrich was one of the very first to do this kind of work, and he did it on this crime. He had built his own crime lab in his own basement and got to work analyzing and interpreting the evidence. The overalls proved to be the most critical in identifying the brothers. There were stains on the overalls that Heinrich examined thoroughly, and the substance that he found in the stains on the overalls was slightly sticky, and he realized it wasn't blood he was looking at, or oil, or any sort of other, like, stain, ink stain maybe. He realized it was pitch, a viscous substance produced by evergreen trees, particularly pines, firs, and spruces, and in this case, particularly from Douglas fir trees. Inside the pocket of the overalls, he found sawdust from Douglas firs, and he had a light bulb moment. Heinrich theorized that the suspect, that at least owned these overalls, worked as a lumberjack, which, as we know, turned out to be correct because, as you may remember, all three brothers were working at a lumber company prior to this crime. So that's check, check, check. Also, in the pockets of these overalls, he found a crumpled up sales receipt. It was faded and difficult to read, but Heinrich used a technique involving iodine vapor and was able to make out that the receipt had been signed by Roy D'Autremont. Like, his name.
So his name is literally on it.
Yes. Rookie mistake.
Such a rookie mistake.
And it was a receipt from when he was sending money back, $50 to be exact, back to his family in New Mexico. So it's like, he's trying to provide for his family, but, like, don't leave your name in your pants when you're robbing a train.
I keep forgetting, though, they're also kids. Aren't they 16?
They're in their early 20s now.
Oh, no, they're in their early 20s. Okay. But
they're young. They're very young.
But that's still really young, yeah.
But if you're, like, coming up with this whole plan, they're studying everything. They're, like, getting the train scheduled. They're doing a lot of that.
I know. They did months of preparation.
And then he forgot his name was literally.
Then he leaves his pants behind with his name in the pocket.
Yeah.
Why did he leave his pants behind?
Those were in the cabin. They're, like, little, like, base camp cabin that was nearby.
Oh, gotcha.
He didn't, like, take like, off he his was pants.
Just, and... he was robbing a train and then just took his pants off.
Everyone knows you can't rob a train wearing pants.
Yeah, that's ridiculous.
I love going out with friends, but honestly, I don't always want to drink. I've kind of hit that point where I want to enjoy the vibe without waking up feeling gross the next morning. That's why I've been loving these out-of-office gummies from Soul. They give you just enough buzz to feel relaxed, social, and totally present, minus the awful hangover the next day. Soul is a wellness brand that believes feeling good should be fun and easy. Soul specializes in delicious hemp-derived THC and CBD products designed to boost your mood and help you unwind. Their best-selling out-of-office gummies were designed to provide a mild, relaxing buzz, boost your mood, and enhance creativity and relaxation. And the best part? You can really tailor the experience. They come in four different strengths, so whether you're just looking for a little microdose to take the edge off or something a bit stronger to kick back with, you're totally covered. Everything Soul makes is thoughtfully crafted, organically farmed, USA-grown hemp, vegan, gluten-free, and low in sugar. It's stuff that you can actually feel good about putting into your body. And if you're more into drinks than gummies, their new out-of-office beverage is such a good alcohol-free option. Super refreshing and perfect for chill summer hangouts. Bring on the good vibes and treat yourself to Soul today. Right now, Soul is offering our audience 30% off your entire order. Go to getsoul.com and use the code NPAD. That's getsoul.com, promo code NPAD for 30% off.
Okay, so now Heinrich has a name. Additionally, hair on the overalls linked Roy to the crime scene, and Heinrich was able to connect Ray to the crime through a serial number restoration done on the handgun that was left behind.
Oh.
And using handwriting analysis on sales receipts, he determined that Hugh had also been at the cabin near the tracks. And of course, his report on this is lengthy and involved and very detailed, but a portion of that report reads, quote, "From a microscopic examination of the dust, hair, and fibers collected from the pockets, chemical analysis of the stains on the garment, and a study of the set of his garments induced by wear, I am of the opinion that the wearer and owner was a lumberjack employed in a fir or spruce logging camp. I computed him, subject to revision with further data which may be found, to be a white man not over 5 feet 10 inches tall, probably shorter, weighing not over 165 pounds, probably less, age between 21 and 25. When in city clothes, he is a careful dresser, neat in appearance, has medium light brown hair, complexion fair, has light brown eyes, well-developed, and small hands and feet. I found the suspenders of the overalls were handled exclusively from the left side, and also the pockets on the left side to be those most frequently used. The left suspender I found is also set 3/4 of an inch higher over the left shoulder than the right." And then he also found some nail clippings in the pockets of the overalls and deduced that whoever owned them was of fastidious habits, meaning that they were very likely attentive and concerned about accuracy and detail. So
that's a very detailed report, like profiling of a person.
Right. And especially that this was very new at this time.
Yeah.
So law enforcement was completely baffled at this level of accuracy and detail found within Heinrich's report. But they're like, all right, like,
if you say so.
From the tiny details like the sawdust, scraps of paper, and the wear and tear on the overalls, he was able to paint a vivid and detailed picture of the wanted criminals. At the time of the crime in the early 1920s, forensic science was in its infancy in Europe and almost non-existent in the United States. Until now. Heinrich went on to be known as the Edison of crime detection and the Wizard of Berkeley. His techniques are still used in forensics today, and his work on this case helped establish forensic science as a legitimate discipline and led to the founding of America's first crime lab in Los Angeles that same year.
Wow. Very impressive.
So this case is like the start of like a lot in the forensics world, which is really interesting. And one of the main reasons I wanted to cover it, because I think it's really interesting. Even though Edward Heinrich managed to identify the D'Autremont brothers within days, they would remain missing for almost 4 years.
Wow.
Somehow, the brothers managed to escape from the woods unseen, and they made a run for it. They hiked their way south, barely surviving through stretches of extreme hunger and cold. Eventually, they decided to split up. Hugh enlisted in the army, and Ray and Roy, after bouncing around and living in a few different places, they both ended up in Ohio.
Wait, he's a wanted man that they're actively searching for and he joins the military?
Yes. Under a different name, an alias.
I guess things were easier back then. Your face is scanned through everything.
It's not me. It's, I don't know, I list his name later where he actually goes, he enlists under another name, but
okay.
Yeah. Hiding in plain sight type of thing, I think maybe was his tactic. But the twins, they end up in Ohio, and in an attempt to disguise their identity, the three brothers used a variety of fake names. Many of their aliases included the letter J or had the name James worked into them, maybe as a nod to Jesse James, the notorious outlaw that they clearly idolized. Their aliases included E.E. James, Johnny Johnson, and James C. Price. And these fake names would become known as the Trail of J's that law enforcement followed as they tried to track down the missing brothers throughout the years. The search for the brothers was the biggest manhunt of the time, lasting years and more than $6 million in today's money.
Wow.
2.5 million wanted posters translated in 5 different languages with the D'Autremont's brothers' names and faces were plastered all over the world, not just throughout the country. And these weren't basic wanted posters either, with like a basic police sketch or a handful of vague sentences, because remember, they know who they are and they did their research into them. So these were detailed. They had 6 photos. So one poster had 6 photos of the brothers, their full names and descriptions of each brother, some of their known aliases, handwriting specimens from each of the brothers, and a description of their crimes, and which clearly was murder. Like, and they didn't really outline, like, they went into a train car and blew up a mail car. They're like, they're wanted for murder. And there was rewards, large rewards, upwards of $14,000 for information in their capture. The boys were constantly surrounded by people looking for them and talking about them, sometimes right to their faces. One time early on in the search, a man Ray was staying with strapped on a gun and went out to look for the elusive D'Autremont brothers every night. Well, the man he was looking for was literally right in his house.
It was his roommate.
Yeah.
That's embarrassing.
Ray was like, yeah, go get him. Hope you find him.
Yeah, good luck out there. I bet you'll get him tonight.
Ray ultimately decided a name change alone wasn't going to cut it because it was clear that people weren't forgetting about this and it was everywhere. So he bleached his hair blonde and convinced a dentist to pull out one of his front teeth, claiming that it was painful and needed to be removed.
Ooh.
At the time, Ray was living under the name Elmer Goodwin, and Roy was going by Clarence Goodwin. Ray, or Elmer, met and married a young woman named Hazel in Ohio. They got married and had a son. And this is another one of those moments that just doesn't fully add up to this story, because with a massive search operation underway and the brothers' names and faces known throughout the country, you just got to wonder, like, how Hazel did not see those wanted posters and recognize this person that she's grown to love.
Her husband.
Right. It's like, okay, yeah, your hair is bleach blonde and you are missing a tooth, but you're still that person.
Like, you still look like that.
Yeah. So that's just kind of like a question mark surrounding that. But
maybe she liked the outlaw life. Maybe she,
or maybe she was just blinded by love. Like, you're not going to just assume that this person that you love and care about is a wanted criminal, like,
especially a murderer.
I think you would just ignore that, maybe subconsciously, like, that can't be true. This is Elmer.
It's like the beginning of ignoring red flags.
Yeah. Finally, after almost 4 years of dodging the law, their reality caught up with them. In 1927, Hugh was stationed in the Philippines with the army when his sergeant saw a wanted poster for the brothers and recognized Hugh, or James Price, as the sergeant knew him to be. He contacted the authorities and Hugh was brought back to Oregon for his trial, which became quite the spectacle. It had been years, but no one had forgotten or forgiven the brothers, and people were desperate to see Hugh's fate determined. 500 people clamored to be on this jury, and reporters from all over flocked to Jacksonville, Oregon to cover the story. Hugh carried himself with confidence, bordering on maybe even some cockiness, sometimes cracking jokes. He was posing for photos, and he was often seen with his hat tipped at an angle and a cigarette in his mouth. Like, kind of like,
he just thought he was the coolest.
Yeah. There was a mix of sentiments towards this 23-year-old criminal that kind of echoes into today with criminals that we see pass through the justice system and especially highlighted throughout the media. Some people had sympathy for him and found it hard to believe that he was to blame for such this heinous crime. Like, they couldn't put the two and two together, like who they were seeing cocky and like with a hat and being like, you know, full of swag versus like someone who killed four people in cold blood, while others were deeply enraged and wanted him dead and could very clearly see the connection. Part of the former group was a young, ambitious reporter named Mary Kelly, who was covering Hugh's trial. She was eager to prove herself as a reporter and developed a close relationship with Hugh and other members of the D'Autremont family. She would eventually go on to advocate for Hugh for years and tried to tell his story to gain public sympathy and respect for him. Partway through his trial, one of the jurors got sick and died, so the trial had to be put on pause while they attempted to find a new date and start it all over. So as we know, these things can take a really long time. Mm-hmm. So as all that's going on, meanwhile, one day Roy was out for a walk when he saw a wanted poster for him. And clearly this is not uncommon. He's used to seeing them all over the place. But this time something was different about this poster. Hugh was missing from it. So he rushed back to tell Ray about this troubling development, and the twins assumed correctly that this meant Hugh had been found and apprehended. They knew that their time was once again running out and began discussing a possible escape, and this time to Mexico. But they never had the chance. The authorities received a tip from a man who used to work with the twins that he suspected Elmer and Clarence Goodwin, because now they're still together.
Yeah.
And they're
like, they didn't separate, and they're clearly probably twins.
They are twins, and they're marketing themselves as brothers, Elmer and Clarence Goodwin. They're still living, like, you know, it's just like, you got...
Like, they haven't veered too far from their actual identities. Yeah.
So this guy is like, okay, I'm starting to pick up that Elmer and Clarence are really probably Ray and Roy. And not wanting to give the twins another chance to disappear again, the authorities staged a trap. They posted flyers advertising higher paying jobs in their area, which they thought might catch the twins' attention because, of course, they're always after money.
Sneaky.
And sure enough, Roy showed up to respond to the ad, but when he got there, he was arrested. And his twin was not far behind. Officers showed up to Ray's house while he was asleep, and they told his wife, Hazel, that Clarence, aka Roy, had been injured while at the job and was in the hospital. So she woke up her husband and said that, you know, your brother just got injured. We need to go to the hospital. Like, the authority, like, we need to go now. And as they are rushing out the door, they were suddenly surrounded by officers, and Ray was arrested. Hazel, of course, was very confused and distraught at this scene. She had fallen in love with a man named Elmer. They had a son, they had a home, and they had another baby on the way. So why now were officers arresting him? And the real question, why were they calling him Ray? Like,
imagine.
Oh my God.
This person you're married to is someone totally different.
Yep. When she arrived at the jail to say goodbye to the man that she thought she knew through and through, they had a very gut-wrenching parting. She held up their son so he could see Ray, but the young boy that they had named Jackie Hugh started to cry when he realized that the bar separated him from his father. And Ray later described that moment saying, quote, "I was choked up with emotion. My soul sank to zero." Ray wrote a love note to her on the back of his mugshot. So cute.
Romantic.
Despite the snag in this relationship, I don't know how else to describe it. It's a snag.
Snag.
I was waiting. I was like hovering over my computer, like bump in the road. Like, it's an obstacle. It's a snag. But despite this, their relationship would stay strong, and they were together for another 25 years.
So maybe she did kind of know.
I don't know if she knew or if she was just like,
so in love that when she found out it didn't matter.
It's like, well, that person, I don't know that person. I know Elmer, and I know this version of you, and I love this version of you. I don't know. I'm not trying to make excuses. I'm just trying to.
Well, and she's pregnant. That makes things so much harder, too.
He's also going to jail. Like, you could be like, all right.
Bye.
Bye. Well, you can't, because it's also the 20s and women were not set up for success then. Anyway, either way, it seems like no matter what, he was obviously deceptive. He lied a lot. But it seems like his love for Hazel and the family that he created with her was real. So there's that. On June 21st, 1927, Hugh was found guilty of murder. He was terrified of being sentenced to death for the crime, but when the trial was over, he was spared the gallows and sentenced to life in prison instead. The twins were then offered a deal. If they pled guilty and confessed to their crimes, they too would be sentenced to life instead of hung at the gallows. The twins readily agreed to this, and Hugh also agreed to confess as well, hoping it might help the twins' case. Like, so they're all trying to help each other out, getting out of the death sentence. An assistant district attorney named Greg Nielsen took down their confessions by hand, which took all night. He started transcribing at 8 p.m. and didn't finish until 6 a.m. the next day. So almost 12 hours worth of this story just spilling out of the brothers. The D'Autremont's cases are long closed, but some, like Ed Espinoza, the forensic scientist I mentioned earlier in the episode, find it really hard to believe that this story is as simple as one huge failed robbery. As he told Oregon Public Broadcasting, quote, "If I had to postulate, these three brothers were set up to do this for some reason and something was taken. And what that is, we'll never know." All three brothers were sentenced to life at the Oregon State Penitentiary. Though they received the same sentence, their experiences in prison were very different. Hugh worked hard to be a model prisoner. He handled all the printing for the prison and was the editor of The Shadows, which was the prison's magazine. He stayed friends with Mary Kelly, who was the reporter who was covering his story, and she and her family continued to advocate for his release from prison. In 1958, Mary's daughter, Noreen, who had just graduated from law school, worked to help Hugh get parole, and she was successful. In 1958, Hugh was released from prison after spending 31 years behind bars, and he began working as a printer in San Francisco. But his freedom didn't last. He died just 2 months later from stomach cancer in 1959 at the age of 63. Roy did not fare as well in prison. His mental health grew worse and worse, and eventually he grew violent. He was moved to Oregon State Mental Hospital and was diagnosed with schizophrenia. And coincidentally, he had actually worked at that exact mental hospital when he was a young man, and now he found himself as a patient there. In 1950, he received a prefrontal lobotomy, which caused his cognition to decline even further. Very rough. He was eventually granted parole and was moved into a nursing home where he died that same year in 1983 at the age of 83. So he had a very rough go of it. While Ray was in prison, he spent a lot of time painting, reading, and learning languages. He was released on parole in 1961 and got a job as a custodian at the University of Oregon. After being interviewed for a documentary on the crime and his life, Ray said, quote, "After all these years of trying to forget the crimes of the past, those of others as well as those of myself, it seems unreal to me. I find it difficult to believe it was my doing. I'm a man of 73. The man who did this, according to the story, was 23, so they can't have been too much alike." He taught classes on painting and Spanish to senior citizens, spent most of his time painting, and tried to find ways to make the rest of his years meaningful by giving back to society in some way. Public sentiment towards Ray shifted, and in 1972, Governor Tom McCall commuted Ray's sentence, and he ended up dying in 1984 at the age of 84. The crime that the D'Autremont brothers committed on October 11th, 1923 is often regarded with the name as, quote, "the last great American train robbery." But this name is obviously inaccurate. It wasn't great. They completely failed to steal anything and ended their lives of four innocent people who were just trying to do their job. What it was, to them at least, was a holdup. And that phrase feels a lot more fitting to the effect this crime had, not only on the brothers, but on the victims and their families and the railway community as a whole. The brothers thought that this would be an event where their lives would finally begin, but really, the rest of their lives would be held up by that fateful period of violence in the Siskiyou Mountains. It also marked the beginning of the end for the era of train robberies, but also is considered to represent the birth of American criminal forensics, like we talked about. Heinrich's work on the case led to the establishment of the first forensic crime lab in LA in 1923, which was later that same year. And I didn't say it before, but it was actually founded by the director of the LAPD, and that person was a former student of Heinrich's. So it's kind of
interesting. Full circle moment.
It was also by far the largest and most expensive criminal investigation in U.S. history at the time, and today remains one of Oregon's largest as well. The victims, Charles Orrin Coyle Johnson, is buried in Medford, Oregon's Independent Order of Odd Fellows Eastwood Cemetery. Marvin Benjamin Singh is buried in Dunsmuir, California. Elvin Daughtry is buried in Reno, Nevada. And Sidney Bates is buried at Sunset View Masonic Cemetery in El Cerrito, California. The D'Autremont brothers are buried side by side by side at Bellcrest Memorial Park in Salem, Oregon, alongside their mother, Belle. For years after the incident, the crime was retold in songs, films, and various publications, and has been cemented in Pacific Northwest history. Just the same, memorial wreaths have been placed at the tunnel in remembrance of the four victims, and that has been done for decades. Over 50 years after that October morning in 1923, Ray revisited the scene of the crime and reflected back on that day with regret while being filmed for a documentary, wondering aloud, quote, "It makes you wonder what the hell we were thinking." In 2023, as part of the 100th anniversary of the tragedy, the U.S. Postal Service offered a special postmark cancellation stamp, which are those stamps that are used as marks on letters to indicate that a stamp had been used. You know, like the stamp over a stamp on letters. So they issued this special one in commemoration of this, specifically in Ashland at the Ashland Post Office. And its image was a train coming out of a tunnel, and it was created by a retired postal inspector named Dan Mahalko. And he was a self-proclaimed history buff who had always been enthralled with the D'Autremont story, and he was part of the Postal Service and stuff. So it was really cool. I looked up a picture of it and I'll post it.
Very cool.
And lastly, and most importantly, and this is a little different from all of our other episodes, don't even think of going here. Do not go to Tunnel 13.
Okay. Why? Tell us.
Okay. So it's on private property, number one. And number two, it's still an active railroad line. So it's not open to the
public. You're going to get hit by a train.
Yeah. And as we said, don't fuck with trains. We've said that.
Yeah. We have said that.
Multiple times now. So yeah, don't go there. It's not open to the public for general access or hiking, even though there are several hiking trails around it. The PCT is really close by.
You see it from afar?
You can see it from afar. Like, there's people that, you know, go in that area, but it's like
I just
want to make limits. It so clear, like, we are not saying go there, but there are on YouTube, there are so many videos of people being like, if I was to go here, if I knew how to get here, this is how I'd get here. And they do it. And they're just like, if I was here, this is what I would do. And like, it's like, you're very clearly there and it has your name associated with, I don't know.
In your picture.
It's like, at least
in a video of you there.
Wear a ski mask or something and like, don't post it to your YouTube channel. But anyway, it's not a thing you should do. And it is cool. I just think of like that Ted Lasso meme. Do you know the one? Wait, the girl, it's like it's Ted Lasso and like another anchor woman at a news desk. And she's like, now, obviously, don't go and do that. And then Ted Lasso comes in and he's like, now you do whatever you like. Live.
Yes.
Don't anything of the sort. But no, seriously, don't do it.
Don't do it.
But if you do, think of the D'Autremont brothers and the victims, more importantly, that lost their lives there. So yeah, that's the story. That's it.
Cool.
I don't have like a nice little bow ending, but I thought that it was a really cool story and one that everyone in Oregon, it's like, everyone knows about it. And I didn't know it had that tie to the forensic science. So that's cool too.
Yeah, it's a really interesting story. And I think the most interesting part of this story is how badly it went. You know, it was a train robbery, but not really. They didn't even take anything.
And I didn't even mention. So it was nicknamed like the Gold Special. And the brothers.
Was there no gold on the train?
No gold.
So it was just completely pointless.
Well, if they didn't blow up and completely incinerate the mail car, I'm sure there was something value there. Like, there was, you know, everything went through the mail then. You know, there's money checks, there's money, there's jewels, there's like bonds, there's all these things that they could have probably made do with, but they blew it up.
Yeah. So ultimately, it ended up, they got nothing. They killed people for no reason. And not that there was a reason before to, in a robbery, but they literally came out with nothing.
Yeah. And then the stress of living your life after that and being on the run, even
under the radar,
4 years or whatever, I could never do it. How do you not slip up or be like, and then you're just surrounded by wanted posters with your
all the time. Your roommate is looking for you.
Yeah. I don't know.
Yeah, it's a weird, it seemed like a very hard life. And even though justice wasn't served for a while, it seems like they were never living great.
Yeah, I would say I agree with that for sure. They paid the price in other ways. I mean, a lobotomy is rough.
Yeah, a lobotomy is pretty rough.
But yeah, so that's the story of the D'Autremont brothers and Tunnel 13. And that's perfect because I got to go because my camera just died.
Perfect. Well, thank you so much for sharing this story. We will see you all next time. In the meantime, enjoy the view.
But watch your back.
Bye, everyone.
Bye.
Thank you for joining us again this week. If you love National Park After Dark and want to hear exclusive bonus stories, join us on Patreon or Apple subscriptions. Patreon subscribers have access to our National Park After Dark book club, live streams, Discord, and much more. If you prefer to watch our episodes, video episodes are now available on YouTube. If you're enjoying the show, please take a moment to rate, review, and subscribe on your favorite listening platform. And to follow along with all our adventures, you can find us on Instagram, Facebook, TikTok, and X at National Park After Dark.
The Jeff Weiler Columbus Auto Mall is turning up the heat this summer. Buy now with no down payment and no payments for 120 days.
That means no payments until fall.
No payments until fall.
With over 8,000 cars, trucks, and SUVs available, there's something for every budget and lifestyle. Pick your ride, get approved, and drive home today with nothing due until autumn.
But hurry, these offers won't last forever.
Visit Jeff Weiler Columbus Auto Mall and take advantage while selection is strong.